104.3 KTOO Juneau.
It is Friday. Time to relax. Settle in for some conversation to send you off to the weekend. Welcome to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. And coming up, from Bartlett Hospital's registration clerk to CEO, quite a journey for Rose Lawhorn. And no matter what your season in life, Mary Lou Sparts and Richard Stokes are living proof about the ageless power of poetry. And for you weekend bird watchers, why Outer Point is the place to go and why we've got perfect weather for that. Tonight, clear skies, lows 29 to 35 degrees, northeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. And tomorrow, for the rest of the weekend, mostly clear skies with daytime highs in the mid-50s. Juneau Afternoon will be right back after National Native News. KTOO would like to take a moment to recognize that we are on Tlingit Ani, the homelands of the Tlingit people. The borough of Juneau has two clans, the Akwan and the Takwan. The place from which KTOO broadcasts today is the ancestral home of the Tlenedi, of Dog Salmon people, of the Akwan. We acknowledge those families of the Tlenedi who made use of this land and waterway for thousands of years and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
Hansen Gress, Ka eat with the Shu Yi, we Kashuk a yitin. Jin katka ke jin ta khanakaya ha anikak gunishish.
Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Most often in Alaska, new CEOs, school superintendents, college presidents, city managers, and such are typically not homegrown. They're usually imported to our state for their management and finance skills. And although they may be experts in their fields, they usually have a huge learning curve ahead of them. After all, Alaska is a state with weather, geography, and different cultures that can throw a lot of curves at you and at the very least humble you. But that said, it's going to be interesting to watch Rose Lawhorn grow into her job as the new head of Bartlett Regional Hospital because she's been growing into it for a long time. Welcome to Juneau Afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me. I have been working and living here in Juneau for a very long time, and particularly at Bartlett, and I appreciate being on to chat with you this afternoon.
Well, it's great to have you. I'm just kind of curious. You're from Southeast Alaska, so you know a lot about this region going into your job. Where are you from, and where did you grow up?
Well, I have lived in Southeast for the majority of my life here in Alaska, with the exception of a few years up in Anchorage going to school and working in hospitals around Anchorage area. And in Southeast, we have a unique set of challenges, and just the homestead lifestyle and survival, navigating weather challenges, which translates to difficulty acquiring, you know, supplies and meeting our needs in that way. You know, it's definitely something I'm not unaccustomed to. And also understanding the challenges that our patients face with access to services and just going into the grocery store in a small community and not knowing if they'll be able to get their supplies that they need for their health. And not every town has a pharmacy, and how are we going to get medications to those individuals that we serve? And so my experience and growing up here in Southeast Alaska gives me great perspective on the challenges faced by our patients.
So what communities did you live in Southeast?
So I lived actually in Hoonah for 8 years and then Haines for 8 years. And then I've spent the rest of my life down here in Juneau, with being up in Anchorage for 3 years. So, and I came as a young child, so from Massachusetts, actually. So, yeah, it's been quite an experience moving around Southeast and getting, you know, becoming well aware of the needs of small town communities and living and serving in this area.
And that is a huge learning curve for someone from outside, because they just can't imagine all the challenges that logistics pose in Alaska. So you were hired as CEO in March, and how does it feel? Does it feel like it always has, because you've always juggled a lot of responsibilities?
You know, Rhonda, the challenges of moving into this role are, I think, more significant and maybe just slightly different than I anticipated. There is such a broad perspective that I am gaining on the community needs overall. And, you know, the environment and the historical knowledge has really served me well already. And I'm just coming to the end of my third week. And it's been very helpful to have that and to gain the perspective and the dynamics in being a city-owned facility, a city-owned organization, working and operating within the guidelines and just all the reporting structure and how to make progress happen within the guidelines that we have to follow as a publicly operated hospital.
If someone looks at your resume, I mean, it's exhaustive. You have worn so many hats, from starting out as a registration clerk, being a nurse, you know, to a CEO, all in one hospital. I mean, how many different hats have you worn at Bartlett, and which of those you think are the most useful to you now?
You know, that's a great question. I started in the accounting field, and I never thought that I would be in healthcare. In fact, I was sheepish being in the healthcare environment, starting out my career, and I felt like it was a misstep once I realized that while I had a mind for numbers and I was good at the accounting side of things, I felt like, you know, it was maybe a waste of time to be in college for that, and realizing it wasn't going to be my career path. But as I've grown and taken on these management roles, I was in a nursing role at the bedside for a decade or so, and then, you know, moved on to several management roles. The experience that I had and the knowledge I had in those early days in my education helped me really understand a lot about the operations and just the business side of running a hospital. And I can't tell you how many times I've thought back and understood, you know, the financial statements and a good business plans and the marketing side of it, and just really operating the business of healthcare. I gained the provision of healthcare and the nursing side and integration with physician practices and all of that, ancillary services that I gained from being a nurse and from working at the bedside and in departments. But really, every step of the way, I spent some time as a registrar checking in patients and making sure the insurance verification was adequate, and all of those little pieces, as I kind of felt a bit aimless at times, searching for my place and where my profession would really guide me, you know, it's come in useful to me because I have this sense of what happens and how all of these elements of hospital care come together to create a single patient care experience that meets our mission of quality patient-centered care in a sustainable manner. And really, those three elements hits on and touches every area within the hospital. And I have learned the value of every role in this organization. And one of my primary goals is ensuring that the people working in each area understand how they contribute to our mission and that they're so valued. And really, we can only fulfill our mission together as a team, each doing our role and understanding how that translates to the mission and to the patient.
Well, one of the things I thought was interesting is you have done a lot of things in way different areas, but there did seem to be a thread in that. And the thread is that you built a lot of relationships along the way, it seems. And I imagine that that's going to help you a lot, I hope.
I hope so, too. And it already has helped me. And really, you know, when you're when you've got all various specialty services, when you have, you know, hospital hired physicians and primary care physicians, and you've got other organizations and again, ancillary services, we can feel like we are dissonant in our goals, but really understanding how the team comes to the bedside again to take care of the patient is critical. You have to have a good team to deliver quality patient care. And to have a good team that's integrated, you've got to have those relationships. And relationships, in my mind, those that are successful are really built on trust. And when you're working at 2 a.m. delivering care to a patient with a provider by your side, you've got environmental services helping you, you know, turn that room over for the next patient, those relationships build trust. And now as a leader, I walk through my organization and there's trust. I know the people's names, they know mine, and they know they've worked with me in many capacities. And so those relationships really do matter. And it's really the trust that I've gained. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we always agree on the issues. But if there's a trust at the center of it all, we can successfully deliver care together.
Well, of course, trust is now being tested more than ever during this time of the pandemic. I mean, we have to trust each other like we've never before.
Yes.
And I know that you, one of the benefits of having been there for a long time is you know the lay of the land pre-COVID, and you have been part of this long journey home. We hope we're headed home. We're still on it. And a lot of people are wondering, where are we now on this journey as far as the hospital goes?
We are seeing a lot of progress in terms of responding to COVID. We know that there are variants out there. We know that the vaccines are effective in preventing deaths and serious illness from this and hospitalizations. And so, you know, we're seeing light at the end of the tunnel in terms of COVID itself. And the hospital leadership and the board and our assembly got behind this incredible cohesive response to the COVID pandemic. And now as we're seeing care protocols and response from the healthcare field be available to us in taking care of the patient, now we really need to look at the sustainability portion of our mission. So that's one of the biggest challenges that we're facing as a hospital and as an organization is how do we recover from all the expenditures? We maximize grants, we, you know, create efficient processes, look at our staffing and you know, be ready to sustain services in new ways. And I referenced telehealth before, but that's one way that now patients are used to getting the care delivered to their living room. And so anticipating those changes in the classic delivery of healthcare, they're going to be different now. And really COVID, the silver lining of COVID was that we were forced into a situation where we learn new ways of delivering care. And so the sustainability, evolving with healthcare trends, and continuing to meet our mission are really the primary challenges. Another challenge actually is just the burnout that we have experienced just from the weight of the responsibility of responding to COVID as a healthcare profession. And so with that is taking care of ourselves.
Well, I imagine there's way more work involved in adapting to COVID, all the protocols you have, but you mentioned earlier just the huge impact that it's had on the hospital's bottom line, fewer patients, costly ways of doing things to prevent COVID. And recently we heard that there is going to be a 4% increase in fees at Bartlett. Could federal COVID relief money help soften that, maybe delay some of the increases from coming, perhaps?
Yeah, you know, we have maximized all funding capacity that we have, and with rising costs, we have the impact on the patient of our cost of care as an element that we keep at the forefront of our mind. It's very important to us that we make the patient care accessible to people, to all. We all deserve quality care, and we have programs, we have support in place for people who struggle with the financial burden of healthcare. And it's something that we need to be looking at nationally and at the state level, and for sure at the hospital. We do have resources. So if you need care, come to the hospital and work with us, and we'll work with you on making that care accessible and manageable in terms of the financial impact.
Boy, there are a lot of things to juggle coming into a job. You know, if you were going to have this job, you probably would have wished that it were at a different time. But then again, who then to have in this role who's seen the big picture over the long haul?
Thank you. And, you know, I don't know if there's, I guess growth is uncomfortable at times. And really the commitment to Juno and to our friends and neighbors and to the teams that are here, the Bartlett family, the Bartlett heroes, has driven me to take this next step. And I am so honored to have been selected to be the next CEO and to be fulfilling this role for our hospital that means so much to me and in our community, in our region. I'm just so honored and appreciative of this opportunity.
Well, thank you so much, Rose Lawhorn, the new CEO of Bartlett Regional Hospital. Thanks for spending time with us today. And I hope that as time goes on, as there are different evolutions of us getting past COVID, that you'll come back and check in with us and keep us up to date on what's happening at the hospital.
I would love to. Thank you. Community communication is important. I want everyone to understand where we're headed as an organization and how we're going to continue to take care of our community and our region. So thank you so much, Rhonda.
And thank you for being here to answer our questions. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. You know, we have the popular image of the modern poet as sort of this young, starving artist in a garret living on ramen noodles, maybe some peanut butter, pasta, pining away for a lost love. But our guests today are here to disabuse us of those notions. Richard Stokes and Mary Lou Spartz are with the Byrne Thompson Poetry Writing Group, and I am just so thrilled to have them here to share their poetry. I'm going to start with you, Mary, because you just turned 90. When was that?
I know, it's a surprise.
A surprise after 90 years. How about you, Richard? Can I ask that sensitive question? How old are you?
I'll be 82 in July.
Oh, my goodness. And both of you, you know, are still following your passions. And I have to ask you, Mary, at what age did your love affair begin with poetry?
Oh, it goes back to high school, I guess. Yeah, must be high school.
And how did that happen?
I was writing. I didn't quite know what it was, but I was writing. And I chose to share some of my work with my contemporaries. And they immediately poo-pooed my effort. So I learned early on that rejection was going to be a part of what was going on. And then I went off to other things, and I came back to poetry many years later.
I guess it does take a certain amount of courage to pull those things out of yourself and put them on paper, and then it's even more scary to share it with people. How about you, Richard? When did you start paying attention to poetry?
Well, first of all, I came to Juno 50 years ago this week, and accepted a job with the Department of Environmental Conservation, and although the department would not become official until July the 1st of that summer. And I feel safe in saying I had never written anything creative before that time, unless it was forced upon me, you know, in high school. I'm sure I had to write something. But I had had no interest in writing, really, until I came to Alaska and immediately started thinking I had things to write about. And poetry did not come quickly even then. I like to think that I just started, but actually looking at the years, it's been about 40 years since I just started. So I got a late start. I was an organic chemist by training, and I avoided the humanities and English courses and great literature. So I missed a lot that I probably will never catch up. But I'm glad that I'm catching up.
But it goes to show you that no matter how late of a start you get, that it's possible to still write poetry. And you have had some poetry that's very powerful, very compelling, both of you. So I guess let's start off kind of with poems that you like, and then we'll get into your poetry. So Mary Lou, you've brought something to share with us today. Tell us about the poem and why you selected it.
Well, I brought my friend and poet Sheila Nickerson, who lived in Juneau for a period of time and provided us with wonderful poetry, and she was well received nationally. So we came to expect that every now and then Sheila would come up with another chapbook, and she did. And I brought this particular chapbook. It's called In the Compass of Unrest. And in there, I've got a poem marked that I like. Shall I read that?
Well, before you start, explain to some of us who may not know what a chapbook is.
Oh, a chapbook is a small collection. I don't remember how many words, lines, 50? Richard does this.
Usually 30 to 40 pages.
Yeah.
So a mini book.
It's a little mini book, and it's usually bound with a stapled spine, not always, but very often, and it's usually printed locally, and self-published, and then distributed to whomever wants to take it in terms of bookstores, and friends, and so that's a chapbook.
So you've got it there. It looks a little like a little yellowed, like you've had it for a while.
I'm sorry?
It looks a little yellowed, like you've had it for a while.
Yeah. Well, I'll go ahead and read then. Mermaid's Tears is the name of this poem. Even mermaids cry. Their tears, which some call glass, lie round and smooth on every beach. Picking one up, you think you hold coke or milk or magnesia, but what you hold is grief. Slipping one in your pocket, perhaps for a child, you carry it home, fingering it softly. Because it pleases you, you forget it. Then, one night, from hiding, comes the sound of crying. You will not know it, turning in the arms of one you love or swimming through your sleep, but something makes you stir and see the beaches of the world. You are standing at their edge, retelling what you know, till pieces fall in colored bits like glass around your feet.
That's lovely.
Isn't that lovely? Yeah.
And why did you choose it?
Well, Sheila, and of course influenced me a great deal in terms of my particular style of writing poetry. She brought together of the imaginative world of mermaids and other fanciful characters, and with the world of words, and also the world of action. In this particular poem, she talks about walking on the beach and picking up glass pieces. We've all done that, I believe, or most of us have, that have been left there by the tide and the beach to get very smooth, and we pick them up because they attract us. We know they're not shells, but they may be a piece of Coke bottle, as she says, or a piece of blue, which is magnesium, milk of magnesia. And I found the way she brought things together and put them in such a an understandable order made me feel very comfortable.
So what happened to your friend? Is she still alive?
Oh, Sheila, yes, as far as I know, I certainly hope so. She and her husband, Martin, moved to Bellingham some years ago, and they also have a home in California. And usually at Christmas, I get a Christmas note that explains their activities for the year, and I'm always grateful to find out what Sheila and family are doing.
I know those Christmas greetings suddenly take on a new importance, don't they, over the years. Well, Richard, what have you got for us?
I have one by, at least one to start, by Ted Kuzler, who was a poet laureate. And before I talk more about him, Mary Lou and I did not compare notes as to what we were going to read today, and I almost picked Sheila Nickerson myself, so that's quite a compliment to her. This poem, and I think the others that I will read, I like images and I like stories. So if there's a narrative, and also vivid images and some sort of ending that means something, those are usually the type of poems that catch my attention. And when you ask us to do this, I dived into some of my books trying to think of, you know, picking favorite poems, and it was just too much of a job. So I decided that I would just pick some poems that appeal to me at the moment, and here goes. This is by Ted Kuzler, Abandoned Farmhouse. He was a big man, says the size of his shoes, on a pile of broken dishes by the house. A tall man, too, says the length of his bed in an upstairs room. And a good, God-fearing man, says the Bible with a broken back. On the floor below the window, dusty with sun, but not a man for farming, says the fields, cluttered with boulders and a leaky barn. A woman lived with him, says the bedroom wall, papered with lilacs and the kitchen shelves covered with oilcloth. And they had a child, says the sandbox, made from a tractor tire. Money was scarce, said the jars of plum preserves and canned tomatoes sealed in the cellar hole. And the winter's cold, says the rags in the window frames. It was lonely here, says the narrow country road. Something went wrong, says the empty house in a weed-choked yard. Stones in the field say he was not a farmer. The still sealed jars in the cellar say she left in a nervous haste. And the child, its toys are strewn in the yard like branches after a storm. A rubber cow, a rusty tractor with a broken plow, a doll in overalls. Something went wrong, they say.
That's lovely. You know, what appeals about that poem, I think, is there's a mystery. Like, after the end of it, it's like, what went wrong?
What went wrong, right? Yeah.
What do you think went wrong? Any theories?
Well, you know, he was not a good farmer, and I feel like something happened to the child. The fact that the toys were left in the yard, I feel like something happened to the child. And I have read some background, and I don't think that Ted Kuza knew what went wrong here either. So,
see, I'm a journalist. I need to know what went wrong. But I guess that's the beauty of poetry, is the poet doesn't have to answer all of the questions.
I hope not.
So let's take a little bit of a break, a pause, and when we come back, we will share some of your own poetry, some of what you've written, all right?
Okay.
Yes.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon, and we are so lucky here to have Mary Lou Spartz and Richard Stokes here for us, coming to share poetry and share what they love about it, so that we too can learn to appreciate it more. And so what I've asked them to do is to share some of the poems that they've written, and I thought we'd start with you, Mary Lou. I know that the two of you recently had a poetry reading for the Byrne Thompson's group at the museum, and I heard many good things about it, so I'm looking forward to hearing your poems.
Well, thank you, Rhonda. Yes, that was a wonderful wonderful moment, a wonderful afternoon for us. And we have to thank the Juno City Museum for the technical effort that they went to and the arrangements. And Alyssa Borges was the person who managed all the technical things about it. We did it on Zoom, as you probably know. And I was very impressed. She did a wonderful job. Thank you so much, Juno mm-hmm. Museum.
Well, it's very different, isn't it, these days to be doing poetry readings next to a microphone or a computer screen. Usually you have people gathered around you. So everybody out there, imagine that you are outdoors on a deck and Mary Lou and Richard are sitting there comfortably reading to you.
This is a poem that I was honored to have published in the recent Tidal Echoes, and it's called Planning Ahead. First, she'd go to the thrift store, pick out a nice J. Crew jacket. Then she'd roll up her long skirt with her black flats, pack them in a backpack, while imagining how it will be. Next, she'd zip the canvas cover around her mandolin, go down to the harbor and take off in a puddle jumper headed for town and the folk fest. This year, she visualized, maybe the tall, graceful guy with the long hair and long arms would ask her to dance. He'd swing her out wide, her beautiful blue skirt swirling around her. He'd smile. She'd smile, and after the dance, he'd say, let's go for a beer at the Alaskan. Maybe later, he'd walk her back to the Driftwood Motel, hold her hand as they walked. Maybe, if the rain is not too hard and the wind light, he'll kiss her at the door. And maybe he'd ask her to play her mandolin while he plays the dulcimer on the street corner, just the two of them. And maybe, well, maybe they'd take up life together with music, dancing, and love.
I don't know whether to laugh or cry. Now, Richard, you have got to like that poem because you said you like a story.
Right.
And we're left wondering, yeah. 6 kids later, what happened to that couple? No.
Right.
So, Mary Lou, before Richard shares his poem, can you tell us about the genesis of that piece of writing? What triggered it?
Well, there were several things. As you know, or maybe you don't, Rhonda, since you haven't lived in Juneau since recently. Am I right there?
Right. I came here in about December. I have, as a journalist, I've covered the legislature, so I've covered several sessions and have spent time here during that period and visited here to do stories, but I don't really know the rhythms of this community.
Well, Folkfest, which was this year just virtual, as we know, and is really the kickoff to spring. And when that comes, we know we're in good hands. We have people coming in from all of the outer communities, and from some from the north, some from Canada, some from the rest of the United States, and they come here to sing, to play, to visit, to get together and have workshops, and just to see old friends, and to dance and sing and enjoy. So it's our opening gun for spring. And that was probably where that all started. And I would go occasionally at that time to the folk fest itself, and it was so enjoyable to watch people dance and to watch everybody enjoying and talking and visiting. It's just really quite an affair.
And your poem was maybe about the beginning of an affair. So, Richard, what have you pulled together for us?
The first one I want to read has to do with Twin Lakes. I live on Twin Lakes, and of course, during the winter, the lake freezes and people congregate. And I've always thought the activity was a little bit like a Ri Munoz painting sometimes, just full of life. And most of my poems are inspired by sights and sounds, and so this has a fair amount of both of those. It's entitled Scores. In winter sunlight, weak but bright, scores of skaters enliven the frozen lake. Laughing children slide and glide, dogs bark, and from a pickup hockey match, clacks and clicks of sticks striking ice, rifle shot cracks from pucks well struck. Figure skaters score lines and loops on the lake's gray skin as bright blades sing from a score of exuberance.
Some amazing images there. So tell us the backstory on that poem.
Well, I think the only backstory is I just happened to be walking by one day when you know, the lake was just alive with people. And there was a hockey match going on, a pickup hockey game. I don't ice skate myself, so I was just walking by as a pedestrian on the bike path. And was struck with what I heard first, and then just the sights of this joyful mayhem, you know, dogs, kids, adults, which I, you know, is just the best part of Juneau.
Joyful mayhem. I'm going to remember that. That's a good phrase. Because what do you call that when two things are contradictory in a term? An oxymoron?
Oxymoron, is,
okay.
I think, yeah.
So let's talk, before we go here, a little bit about where poetry is going. I mean, both of you have seen a lot of decades of poetry, a lot of different trends. I mean, you probably remember what beatnik poetry, and then sort of the free-form poetry that evolved, and now there's been rap, which is like a modern form of poetry. What do you distill from all of that through all your years?
Yeah, I don't really know how to answer that, because my own is so pedestrian in terms of, you know, it's not classic by any means. I don't use a lot of rhyme. I don't pay that much attention to meter. So I don't know how to answer that question. And in particular with rap, I like the way some of it sounds. I don't like many of the lyrics, but I like some of the sounds. I like the rhythm.
Well, it is a form of poetry, and it probably reflects the time, a lot of the conflicted emotions that we have in our time period in history. Mary Lou, what are your thoughts about the state of language today and where it's going?
Well, I haven't thought of it that way. I do know that people are speaking considerably faster than I would like. And every now and then I have to stop someone on the phone and say, will you start again, please, and slow down? Because I think that in terms of how many words you can get into a conversation, it's jumped from something like 85 to 100 and some. So it reflects, I suppose, the kind of incredible period we're in, where things are changing so quickly that we're just breathless trying to keep up.
So you're 90 and Richard, you're 82 now.
82.
So I guess, is poetry something that has served you well across the ages, across the decades?
Well, I think so. And, you know, not only poetry, but the groups that I have been in, like the Byrne Thompson, the other members are, you know, very supportive. Their work is inspiring. We've all developed friendships that go beyond the writing. And really before, and there's some overlap here, I'm from Georgia originally, which is where my accent comes from. And I had a writing group there that traced back to junior college. And there were at one time 7 or 8 of us that wrote, met once or twice a year. And so the friendships and the poetry, the written word and the relationships have both been very, very important.
Well, Mary Lou, we'll leave you with the last word on final thoughts on poetry before we go on.
Well, the poetry, I suppose it's intriguing. There is so much to know in terms of form, and there's so much that is in our literary history that is so impressive that there's just never enough time, no matter what age you are, to absorb all of it. You know, you can start with the great bard and the amazing, amazing work that goes on there. Never gets boring, never gets old, no matter how many times you hear tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And that's the kind of thing that I think it is left to poetry a lot of times, to make it as precise and as near to the heart as possible without finding it unrealistic. I think realism is a real important part. In terms of what's going on at the poetry now, well, I must admit that I do not find a lot of comfort in some of the newer poets. I don't quite grasp what they're trying to tell me. And I have become very, very much a snob of wanting to know what you want to tell me.
Hey, but that's the mystery of it. Well, we've got to leave it there. But I want to thank both of you, Mary Lou Spartz and Richard, for joining us, Richard Stokes. It's been a very nice visit. Thank you so much for helping us come to appreciate poetry.
Oh, thank you, Robert.
Thank you. It's
been really nice to be with you.
Great to have you. Well, we are coming to a wonderful moment in our program. I know that the skies outside beckon, and this is going to be one of those prime time weekends for bird watching. And so we have with us one of the prime bird watchers here with the Audubon Society, Betsy Wright. So, Betsy, I hear that the Audubon Society has a trail marked out so you can see the new arrivals.
Yes, we do indeed, Rhonda, and it's so nice to be out on a beautiful day, and we have some more coming up. And you just have to stop and listen to the sounds now and again so you can enjoy it better.
So what is the bird that we should be looking out for?
Well, right now, we have several that are singing their little heads off. One of them is a full-time resident, the dark-eyed junco. It has a lovely little trill, and I think if you live anywhere with a tree anywhere near your yard, you're going to hear it singing if you step outside.
So where is the trail that you would like to point us to this weekend?
Well, we're suggesting that people go to the Outer Point Trail. That's the last one on Douglas that goes down to the water. And what you're going to see is not only interest in ducks like harlequins and scoters and loons, but possibly also horned grebes and a black oyster catcher. And you'll hear them because they scream when they fly. And pigeon gullimots are just back this week. Marbled murrelets are back in their brown coloring. And we got the red-breasted sapsucker. They just love that area. So you'll hear lots and lots of thumping on trees.
So what are you seeing compared to previous years? Birds arriving a little bit late, a little bit early? What's the overall trend?
I swear, I know this may not be true, but I think every single bird that's arrived in the past week was one 24-hour period behind that warm front that got here. Because the woods are swarming with varied thrush, robins, yellow-rumped warblers are just here, the greater yellowlegs are back. There's a ton of Lapland longspurs and pipits in the grasslands, and the snow buntings haven't left yet, even though you can see them very well now since there's not much snow.
Well, we're about out of time here, but point us to where we can get to this trail that you've got set up for a self-guided trail.
Yeah, so Outer Point Trail is you just take the North Douglas and keep going past Fish Creek right before the turnout where you stop at the very end of the road. There'll be a parking spot to your right, and you just follow that downhill to the water, and you can go from there over to the Rainforest Trail, too, if you like. And at low tide, you can actually go out to Shaman Island.
Oh, my goodness. And when you get out to the island, I bet you see a lot more because the birds are a little more isolated, maybe a little more free to be birds.
Well, it's interesting because that's a crow rookery. So sometimes you might see 1,000 crows and not much else.
Oh, those crows. Well, thank you so much, Betsy Wright, for giving us a sense of where we might go to enjoy the birds. We really appreciate
it. Yes. Get outside and enjoy. It's beautiful.
Support for Juno Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klinkit & Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.